Ever since I was a kid, I've gazed at my globe or paged through my world atlas and imagined how every borderline does more than just define countries. It tells a story. Who made that line? Who won? Who lost? How clean is the division? How did these lines change over the centuries? Journalist John Ehrlich has been exploring the complicated way borders have been shaping human history and doing so for as long as we've been around to draw these borders. He's written a fun-to-read book called A Brief History of the World in 47 Borders. It tells the stories behind some of the world's best-known borders and some of its most controversial ones. He joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to uncover how these invisible lines have influenced our history and how they shape the world we live in today. John, welcome.
Hello, Rick. Thank you very much for having me.
What a fun topic to delve into. And you write that today's maps divide the land masses of planet Earth into roughly 193 discrete bits, most of which are less than 2 centuries old. What a fun book to focus on. Now, how did you get interested in borders as a way to delve into history?
Oh, there are all sorts of answers to that question. It's kind of a lot of different things came together. Part of it was that I was looking at a map of the world, as you were saying, you have yourself, and it sort of just hit me in a blinding flash one day how these things we call countries are completely manufactured. You know, at some point, somebody had to make them up, and every one of them has borders that could have gone elsewhere. And I was just thinking, like, why do we have the countries we have? Why do we have the lines on the map where they are? And also, as I was thinking about this, we were here in the UK, we were coming towards the crescendo of the Brexit process, of leaving the European Union, which was changing the way Britain's borders functioned. So it kind of felt like a very contemporary topic as well.
That's interesting. That is, as a Brit, I think having lived through the whole Brexit thing, it does get you thinking about borders. Now, as a traveler, I can think of some very memorable border crossings, and I'm kind of sad that these days more people fly from big city to big city and they don't even have that experience to cross a border. Can you think of any particular border crossings that you've found memorable or interesting?
I have to say, tragically few. As you suggest yourself, most of the time I've crossed a border, it's been in an aeroplane or occasionally in a train. Like, yeah. I think one of the sort of greatest sort of engineering achievements the human race has ever managed is the Channel Tunnel, which links England to France. And the fact you can get on a train in London and get off it in Paris or Brussels or even at certain times of the year in the Mediterranean.
And John, I got a hunch you're young enough not to remember being sniffed by dogs as you went from England to France. Now, the beautiful thing about ideally in the modern age within countries that work well together is borders become less of a deal. You hardly know when you're going through a border. When I started traveling, getting your passport stamped was part of the fun. And now it's almost hard to find a place to stamp your passport when you're crossing around in Europe. So borders are getting less of a thing. And we kind of forget that they do matter.
They do. But also one of the reasons, as I was saying, one of the reasons that this topic was felt so current to me is because my country had made the slightly unexpected decision to make its borders more difficult to cross.
Yeah, that's going backwards to me as a traveler.
Exactly. Like I've got very used to the fact that I had a legal right to live in any one of 27 other European countries. And after a democratic vote here in 2016, that has changed. I no longer have that right.
So, John, do you think, when you think of borders, generally we're talking about political borders? There's other ways to think of a map and borders, aren't there? There's linguistic borders, ethnic borders, religious boundaries, free trade zones. How do these relate to each other and what do they have to do with modern borders today?
So one of the questions that I keep coming at in the book is like the relationship between physical geography and national identity. And I kind of came to the conclusion that actually while these two things do sort of influence each other, it's kind of irresolvable as to kind of which came first. But I think you can probably say that about all these different kinds of borders as well. Like, so you will get in a continent like Europe, you will get different linguistic groups that will often be divided by natural features like mountain ranges or major rivers or so on. But they're not always. You also get countries like Switzerland, which makes no sense whatsoever. If you kind of think of the nation state as being a sort of construct of a group of people that generally have a similar language, often a similar culture. Switzerland is kind of a challenge to that whole conception of what a nation is because it's 3.5 different language groups And the main thing that's held the Swiss together through 800 years of history is not wanting to be part of any of the countries that surround it.
John Ehrlich writes occasional columns for The New Statesman. He's also a guest commentator on BBC Radio from time to time and writes about politics, urbanism, and social issues for a number of newspapers and online magazines. John's with us on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about some of the surprises he's uncovered in his book, A Brief History of the World in 47 Borders. John's also written The Compendium of Not Quite Everything. He has a subscription column on Substack and shares more on his website, johnellege.wordpress.com. That's spelled J-O-N-N-E-L-L-E-D-G-E. Now, if you look at a border in a troubled part of the world that is a straight line, you can look at that straight line and think that's the root of the troubles we read about in the newspaper. Mm. Talk about that in the context of the Middle East, with the straight lines on the borders that separate Syria and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and so on. Those were made not by locals who understood the ethnic realities, but by colonial powers, European powers, France and Britain, right?
Yeah, so generally speaking, if you're ever looking at a map and you see a straight line, it is a sign that an imperial power at some point has been dividing territory up with one of its rivals, probably in a conference room many hundreds of miles away from the place you're looking at. So the most famous straight line in the Middle East, the line in the sand, was the result of an agreement called Sykes-Picot, which was signed between the British and the French in the middle of World War One. Where basically the Ottoman Empire, which had controlled that part of the world for many centuries at that point, was widely agreed to be on its last legs.
Okay, so let me do this in a nice British accent, which you'd be better at than me. But in 1915, these fancy aristocrats and diplomats in London or in Paris got together talking about the Middle East, talking about Syria and talking about Iraq. And they said, I should like to draw a line from the E in Acre to the last K in Kirkuk. And then they would draw that line. They were looking at some goofy map, and they drew it from one word to the other on the map. And to this day, that line survives, and it's caused a lot of bloodshed.
Yeah, I mean, in 2014, 2015, ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, the sort of upstart Islamic fundamentalist movement, was trying to erase that line, trying to create a new Islamic fundamentalist state that would take territory from both of those countries.
And much as we didn't like what ISIS was doing, to be honest, if you look at the state they created for a little while, the Islamic State, IS, that's the state that should have been recognized 100 years ago when they drew that line in the sand, I would think.
Should is a very difficult word because
but it represents
yes,
the ethnic and the religious passions of the people there, isn't it? Doesn't it?
Yes, arguably. I mean, I'm going to be honest. We're dancing on the edge of my knowledge here, so I don't want to come out and say I think ISIS was correct because I don't have that level of granular knowledge about that region. But one of the problems you run into again and again in a lot of world history is that actually you can't neatly separate different ethnic or linguistic groups into different geographical regions. Like one of the themes of 19th and 20th century European history is people effectively being ethnically cleansed to create these kind of pure nation states that are just like one ethnicity. When in fact, if you look at much of Central and Eastern Europe, it never worked like that. It's an attempt to impose a particular concept, the nation state, idea that everyone in the geographical region should share an identity onto a part of the world that hasn't historically worked like that. And I think there are elements of that in the Middle East as well, which is why I'm saying, the line in the sand was act of imperialism. It was two European imperial powers dividing up a part of the world they had no particular business being in between them. But nonetheless, I don't think you can necessarily say that the people on either side of the line should, it's as simple as they should be one nation. It's more complicated than that. It generally is.
John, we can look all over the globe and find examples of this. Of course, Spain and Portugal decided, back in 1494, to draw a longitudinal line, a north-south line, and it said everything east of this line is Portuguese, everything is west is Spanish. Of course, Portugal and Spain don't rule these countries anymore, but Brazil speaks Portuguese, and everything to the west of that line, the other countries, is Spanish to this day.
It's incredible, isn't it? Just imagine two royal families just drew a line down the middle of an ocean and said, like, right, this side of the world is yours and this side of it is ours. Just like the sheer level of presumption.
Even beyond that, you wrote in your book, I love the way your book is little bite-sized stories. So it's just a delight to read. And you talked about how they actually decided over in Spain and Portugal or whatever, that 370 leagues west of Cape Verde Islands is a longitude line that runs all the way to the South Pole. I don't even know what a league is, and I doubt if I could find Cape Verde Islands in the Atlantic, but 370 leagues west of those islands, that's going to be the line that was just arbitrarily plucked out of the blue, was the line that separates Brazil from the rest of Spanish-speaking South America.
I believe I'm right in saying that a league is roughly 3 miles. It's the distance a man can walk in an hour, although that's obviously harder in the Atlantic Ocean. But one of the incredible things about that line is they didn't really know what it was going to run through. So there is an argument that when these two royal houses drew that line, they didn't realize they were going to be dividing up the continent of South America as well. They may have thought they were just putting it down the middle of an ocean, and it's pure chance that it happened to give this kind of the eastern tip of South America to the Portuguese, which half a millennium later means the large and thriving nation of Brazil still speaks Portuguese to this day.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with John Ehlich, and his book is A Brief History of the World in 47 Borders. John, I think a lot of us forget that there didn't always need to be borders because people were just in tribes that were roaming around, and bully tribes were pushing the meeker tribes to less desirable land and then established where they were. When we look at the map, how can we draw some of those memories of the story of humanity out?
I think that era, it's kind of hard to see on the map. I do think there are a couple of modern nation states that are kind of empires that never fell, which we sort of forget sometimes. But the modern forms of both Russia and China are basically leftover empires from the golden age of such things. But if you go back far enough, as you suggest, borders were less necessary because people were more likely to be mobile. People were only settled within the last few thousand years. And also borders function differently. And if you look at the borders of the ancient Roman or Chinese empires, they weren't necessarily the hard lines we imagine them to be now. They were more likely to be sort of fuzzy no man's lands where imperial control gradually peters out. So something like Hadrian's Wall in the north of England, which divided the Roman province of Britannia from the wild lands of Caledonia in the north, was probably not a hard border so much as kind of a tripwire so that you could kind of monitor people moving in and out of the empire and tax them rather than it being like, you know, a stop line at the edge of Roman territory. And for most of human history, that is probably how borders functioned, because we simply didn't have organized polities all over the planet in the way we do now.
You know, when you mentioned where an empire peters out, that reminded me of crossing from Iran to Afghanistan. I mean, that was probably the most godforsaken piece of real estate I've ever had the privilege of sitting at waiting for somebody to come and check my passport, was this no man's land between the Afghan people and the Iranian people. And it wasn't a river. It wasn't a big wall. It was just, we don't care anymore anything further beyond here. And we don't care anymore anything further beyond there, where the Iranian and Afghan people, you know, drew the line.
This is a recurring theme in the book as well. Like some of the borders I was looking at, I was trying to get answers about why, for example, this are the European microstates, the four or five very, very tiny independent states that still exist. I was thinking, like, why is Andorra still there? Why is Liechtenstein still there? And often the answer is simply because it is. It's just like a series of historical coincidences that mean nobody ever absorbed it into a bigger state. And that is true so often of lines on maps. It's like you can dig down into it as much as you want, but ultimately you find that a line is where it is because nobody put it somewhere else.
Okay, and then there's the other, almost the opposite, where it's the remnant of a big event. Let's say you've got India, which is a big imperial mess of fighting Hindus and Muslims, and they decide to draw a couple of extra lines, and what do you get?
So, yeah, that was one of the stories I actually found the most difficult to read about and then write about, partly because the partition of India, a lot of people die. There's a lot of ethnic cleansing going on, and it's not so much British imperial action so much as inaction. The British Empire is tired. We have no money after World War II. And so the British Empire pulls out of a couple of imperial possessions at very short notice.
You know, this reminds me of the American pullout of Afghanistan. It was just, we were running out of steam, a lot of heartache, a lot of bloodshed. We're gone. And then it just leaves the people there to sort things out. When the Brits pulled out of their Indian colony, you end up with a lot of dead people in Bangladesh and Pakistan.
Yeah, it's an underrated way in which empires can do damage is not just through imperial aggression, but through imperial disinterest as well. Yeah, no, the story of partition is probably the most violent in the book. I can't recall the figures, but it is, the death toll is numbered in the millions. It's horrifying.
John, in your book, you wrote, sometimes the borders are fleeting, sometimes they persist for centuries. Some are funny, some are absurd. Some brought forth a death toll that ran into the millions. Boy, oh boy, you've got 47 borders that you have chapters on in your book. Let's wrap up our discussion with just one border that we haven't talked about yet that's particularly interesting or poignant to you.
So one of the stories I found most interesting in the book was one of the most obscure, which is the story of the Ugandan-Sudanese Border Commission of 1913, which, unlike, say, the partition of India or the Korean demilitarized zone, is not something that people tend to think about these days. But it's a story in which two British imperial possessions at the time, they need to work out where the line between them goes. So they get a survey team, half officers from the Sudanese side of the line, half of officers from the Ugandan side of the line, and they're both led by these kind of British army captains. And one of them is a decent sort. He's a very good chap. He wants to do right by the locals. He's very determined to find out exactly where all the local tribal territories are. And his opposite number is just tired and wants to go home. So we have extensive diary entries showing the slow motion collapse of the relationship between these two men as they gradually work their way east towards the Indian Ocean. And eventually the tired guy just gets sick of it and goes home, taking his survey team with him. And the other guy pushes on for a little bit, but he's tired too by now, and everyone's got their legs ripped to shreds by formed scrub, and all the animals are dying of hunger. So he gives up. And if you look at the border on the map of Africa to this day, there is a border that starts out in a very, very detailed, but the further east you go, the kind of more and more sweeping the lines become. And to the last couple of hundred miles, it's just a straight line. And again, it's imperial disinterest, but it's also showing that, you know, even noblesse oblige does tend to end quite badly, and probably we should allow people to make their own borders rather than imposing them from outside.
John Elledge, thanks for writing A Brief History of the World in 47 Borders. And in your book, you reminded us that John Lennon sang about imagining a world with no borders. Can you imagine a world with no borders?
I tragically can't. I mean, one of the reasons I got interested in this topic is because I grew up with Star Trek. I sort of imagined we were moving to like one world government and that the European Union was a step on that road. And given events of the last decade of world history, I feel much less certain that that is the direction of travel. I think nation states and borders might be with us for the long term.
Hang on to your passport and get ready to deal with customs if you're going to see the world. Thanks, John, for your book. And what a great topic to delve into.
Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Kasmira Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Look at Rick's checklist for what to pack in your suitcase and share tips with fellow travelers. It's part of our online travel forum that you'll find at ricksteves.com. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.